A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man, and that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Shocking, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. If you've listened to this before, you know that I am, of course, your host, Matthew Soul. If you have not, you just learned something new. Let me teach you another new thing. With me, of course, is my co-host and research extraordinaire herself, Holly Soul.
Hey, everyone.
Also, we're married.
Surprisingly.
Because sometimes we may or may not address it, so it's like we could be siblings, you know, we could be cousins.
We get lots of people going, where do you get your chemistry from? 10-year relationship.
That's how you do it, folks. If you want to be even a little bit successful in the world of podcasting, find a partner. Make sure that she has this very similar interest to you, at least in regards to podcasting. Put together a podcast, but you have to have about, you know, 5 or 6 years, and then you'll still have to have a day job, but you will have an audience, which is wonderful.
Yes, something like that.
Something like that?
Moving on.
Or for the low price of
marriage.
7 years and how, well, we've been together 10 years,
with
4 years of marriage, 5 years this year.
Five this year.
Whew. Look at it go. That's time. Lickety split. Well, speaking of time, it's time to go back in time. We're actually going to be talking about what a lot of people consider to be one of Australia's very first freedom fighters. And coincidentally enough, the tradition of freedom fighting in Australia starts around the same time that bushranging does. It's almost like we've just got this roguish impulse in our nature.
We're the born hero imported.
Yeah, exactly right. So every society around the world boasts having a freedom fighter or two, and Australia is no different. Now, to suggest that the Aboriginal peoples were happy with European settlement of Australia is a rather bizarre narrative, I think. But it does get kind of peddled every now and again.
Yeah, I know a few people who are like, yeah, they were happy about it. I'm like, dude, you know nothing.
They like
you're a fucking idiot.
Now, Australia's most famous Indigenous freedom fighter is today's subject, I should say, rather, and that is Aboriginal freedom fighter Pem Uwoy. Pem Uwoy.
Woy.
God damn it.
It's phonetically, you know, at the top of
the
notes.
Pem Uwoy.
Yes. Pem Uwoy.
Pem Uwoy.
He's Australia's answer to John Wick. That's what Matthew's written down here.
Well, I think he is. I think he is. You know, it's like... in this case, though, his puppy is actually his tribe, the tools of his trade were not guns, but rather some pretty slick tactics and an exceptionally good throwing arm.
Yep. Pem Uwoy was born in about 1750 in the Botany Bay area. Now, he was a member of the Eora Nation as part of the Bidjigal clan. Bidjigal. I think it's Bidjigal.
We apologize.
I had it. It's right in my head. It just never translates to my tongue. It's really annoying.
Yeah, we try so hard and we always fail at this, but we're doing our best. We're good. You know, to all of our Indigenous listeners, we're really, really, really
we
sorry.
Thank you for sticking with us this long.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
The translation is the River Flat Clan, which is probably how I'll actually refer to it from now, just so I don't butcher that name again. The River Flat Clan. Now, Pem Uwoy's name derives from a Darong word, Pemel, meaning earth or clay. European versions of his name include Bimbleway, Bimblewove. The ABC called him Pimbloy. The Australian National Museum of Australia also puts forth Bembilwoyam.
So everyone had a name for this guy.
Well, I don't know what his birth name is because he got so many names over the course of his life.
But that's kind of what happened in back when record keeping wasn't the greatest, because we are going all the way back to the very first days of Australia becoming even visited by Europeans. I mean, we're going back, I want to say, She just gave me a hand signal.
240.
240 years we're going back.
Now, it's not specific to Aboriginal Australians. There are lots of cultures around the world who you adapted and grew names as you grew older.
Yeah,
Pemulwuy absolutely. Is one of them.
Well, I mean, that's the origin of names. It's, you know, it's why a people description. Have. Yeah, it was a description. It's like, you know, Lisa Cobbler. Why? Because her family were cobblers.
She either married to or was descended from cobblers.
And then what also happens if you end up with last names that are actually, you know, related to the area in which your family comes from. Your last name now that we share, Soul, is French because of a French dandy convict that bounced around the world a lot.
Pemulwuy was described as well-built with a few character-defining impairments. Pemulwuy's left foot was clubbed or maimed. This doesn't seem to be a birth defect. This seems to be something that was added later on. It's been claimed that this was done to Pemulwuy in order to mark him as a Karate, which is a clever man, so a wise leader of his tribe.
Yes, not related to the TV show Clever Man, how I'd also would recommend checking that out. It's
ABC produced, wasn't it?
Yes, still is. I think they're going to season 3, and it's about there's a group of people that they refer to as like their spiritual leader is the Clever Man, and he's like granted powers from a meteor. I've only seen the first episode, but it's on my list. Maybe I've got 3 episodes I've watched. Anyway, I completely fucking sidetracked this, which is what I often do. Is that actually substantiated? Was that a tribal practice of like giving someone such a distinct impairment to mark them? Like that would seem to go be counterproductive to survival.
Not necessarily. There are anthropological reasons and then there are a reason specific to the clan. You will never find reasons specific to the clan because it is an oral tradition. Oral traditions get lost, especially when they won't or refuse to talk to Europeans to write it down. Unfortunately, this seems to be a practice where they refuse to talk to the European about it. Anthropologically.
And just to save Holly's bacon there, when she means they're not talking to the Europeans, she's talking about the Europeans 240 years ago, not current day Australians.
The oral tradition is lost, so yep. I doubt the people around today are going to know any more than the white guys studying them.
I guess this is my fault. I'm always gung-shy of social media. Mm-hmm. So I'm always like, okay, could that be taken in the wrong way?
I'm like, well, I've already said that. anthropologically, if you have a clever person, you don't need them out hunting because if they're out hunting, they might get hurt, they might get killed. Therefore, you maim them, they can't go out hunting and therefore they're going to stay in camp. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that that might be an explanation.
Yeah, I could understand that. Yeah, for sure. And then also, it's a defining icon of the tribe. So you always know who your clever
When you
man
walk
is.
In, you know who is in charge because he's the one walking around with a limp.
Yeah. I can see
Same
that.
As some tribes putting a bone through the ridge of their nose or, you know, eyebrow piercings or what is it now, a tie?
I don't fucking know anymore, man. I haven't looked at the world. The last time I looked into the world of anthropology was when the Christian missionary from America went over and got his ass killed.
I was actually making fun of politicians because they always wear ties, so therefore they're the leaders because they're wearing ties.
I see what you're saying. Right. Sorry.
Now, Pemulwuy was actually set apart to become a clever man because he was born with a strange blemish in his left eye. It sported a series of strange dots, or it was an overly dilated pupil, David Bowie kind of eyes, something like that, that made him look a lot different to everyone else.
David Bowie's eye, do you know what caused
that? Someone punched him.
Yeah, he got punched in the face and it damaged the nerve that helps with, you know, with the shutter
contraction,
of the eye. The contraction of his pupil. The way they sort of talk about this, I almost wonder if it's more along the lines of, you know, maybe he had like a birth defect, a split pupil. You know more about
it. It doesn't
eye stuff
even
than
need to be that strange. It might be, you know, have you seen some of the defects where people's pupils look like teardrops because one part of the muscle is collapsed and it no longer contracts
I've
anymore?
I've never seen that. That's awesome.
Have a look it up. You can look it up.
I mean, probably not awesome for
one
the
of the guys,
going through it.
One of the guys that I work with has that, except his goes down into the bottom corner. So it doesn't look quite as cool, but it's still very interesting to try not to stare at when you're talking to him.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, so that's some kind of what might happen. This might be what happened to him. There's also a birth defect where you can actually get colors of the iris in spots on the white part of your eye. So that might also be what it was. Unfortunately, photography not being a thing and generalized concepts of Aboriginals being painted, we don't actually have a physical manifestation concurrent with his lifetime of what Pemulwuy looked like.
Yep. We just have to make some guesses.
I can only speculate.
If you really need a lot of help with it, think Jason Momoa.
What do you mean?
If you're having what do you look like? Visualizing yeah. like-
Jason you know. Momoa with a David Bowie eye and a sore ankle. That's what you're looking at.
Yeah. Why not? Like, because whenever I think of like Freedom Fighter, I always think of Jason Momoa.
It's because he's 8 foot tall and built like a brick shit house.
Yep. Chris Hemsworth's too soft. I love Chris Hemsworth. He's our boy. We love Chris Hemsworth. Jason Momoa just looks like-
takes up a step.
Yeah. It's like if I'm going to choose between one of the two to lead me into the apocalypse- I'm going with Jason Momoa.
Pemulwuy was the first of his people to fight a guerrilla war against the European settlers. Now, he managed that for 12 years, reportedly from the year of 1790, but it's more likely to have occurred soon after settlers landing in 1788 around the Sydney Basin. Because as soon as people come in and take your land, the first thing you're going to say is, fuck you, get off my land.
Well, one of the interesting things that they've discussed is... and, you know, they bring this up when they talk about Indigenous affairs. You know, they'll go, oh, well, they had no concept of land. And it's like, yes and no. It wasn't a concept of like turn it into a paddock and put a fence around it. It was they had a connection to the land in the same way you have a connection with your mother. Your mother births you and looks after you and sustains you. That's how they see the continent. That's how they see the dirt itself. And so it was like having all of these people suddenly like run all over your mother.
Okay.
Yeah, that works. That's how they saw it. They saw a bunch of people, you know, abusing something that was sacred to them. And then suddenly they were like, oh, and you're also bringing stuff to make our life a bit easier, like food. We're going to take that food. Hey, this is our food. Well, we don't actually understand this concept of this is yours, this is mine, you know, this is our
community. Communal.
This is our home. You're on our home. Therefore, your stuff should be to whoever can spare it.
I feel like the Aboriginals would have seen the Europeans rock up the first time and they would have gone, have you ever lived through an Australian fucking summer? We need the food that we got. Thank you very much.
I think they probably saw them and thought, holy shit, we're being attacked by spirits and shit.
I'm pretty sure, maybe racist, but that's what the native Indians thought.
Understandably.
From America, not India.
Considering how pasty white those British folk were when they left Britain to colonize America, I completely would understand that. And the same applies here.
Like I said, might be racist, might be wrong, what I learned. So there was a low tolerance for Aboriginal people living within the Sydney Basin, especially as the European settlements spread out into the future state of New South Wales. The burgeoning Governor Philip of the new settlement needed an enforcer to keep the Indigenous people away from European settlements and their future farmlands. They found that man in John McIntyre, an ex-convict and gamekeeper who arrived upon the Alexander in 1788. McIntyre was literally aboard the same ship as Black Caesar from episode 20.
Now, just a quick refresher on Black Caesar. We and... most Australian historians worth their salt attribute the first bushranger to him. They, like the tactics that he would employ, start an amazing tradition of roguish bushranging in Australia. Some were devilishly handsome folk. Captain Moonlight is one that we've talked... Was it Captain Moonlight we talked about?
The Holy Ranger, yes.
Yes. There's the dapper gentleman down in Tasmania.
Matty Brady.
Yes. We haven't covered him yet. No, not properly.
Not yet. We mentioned him.
Women swooned for him. Yeah.
And then there were smash and grabbers like Ned Kelly or Ben Hall.
I mean, yeah, Ned Kelly was
he was a bank robber. He wasn't really much else than that.
And and eventually planned to be a domestic terrorist as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aside from being one of the convicts that pushed Caesar out into the wilderness, McIntyre did what he could as Governor Phillip's gamekeeper to keep the Aboriginal people from hunting the animals he was charged with raising. The First Fleet faced a harsh land that they didn't know how to farm, and thus everyone ended up in a feed-me-before-them mindset. People were starving, and their treatment of the local peoples didn't engender any help. Neither did the outbreak of smallpox that decimated the local peoples in 1789, or the arrival of more people, some sick, others dead, in June 1790.
It's an interesting concept to think about. Like, I liked that line there, Holly, that you just brought up. The, like, you know, and the way that they treated the local people didn't, in, you know, engender them at all. And I wonder if there's like a parallel Earth where humans were less territorial, less tribal, less violent, where, you know, they rocked up on the land and were like, oh, there are already people here. Let's go have a chat and maybe we can exchange culture or maybe we can talk to each other.
From memory, that's what the Native Americans wanted to do until the Europeans shot them.
I don't know enough about American history to comment.
And that's what I understand of Thanksgiving.
Gonna keep 2 feet out of that arena. And that's not because I believe in anyone's particular narrative. I just don't know enough to comment about it.
In a previous episode, we discussed how our first bushranger, Caesar, spent most of his first years in Australia escaping and raiding Aboriginal encampments. This compounded the poor treatment of the Indigenous population, who were copying it from European settlers, and the rebels who were disappearing into the bush to stick it to the man, as it were. The burgeoning bushranger movement was causing just as many headaches for the Indigenous peoples of Sydney as it was for the European settlers. Now, we have a quote here from David Collins in 1789.
It having been found that the arms and ammunition which were entrusted to convicts residing at the distant farms for their protection against the natives were made a very different use of. An order was given recalling them and prohibiting any convicts from going out with arms, except McIntyre, Byrne and Randall, who were licensed game killers.
Now, it's because of this decree officially stripping weapons away.
I decree! Sorry, I had to do it.
It's because of this decree officially stripping weapons away from the majority of the convict settlers that Pemulwuy would soon find himself facing off against McIntyre in December of 1789. And as you could imagine, this meeting would not entail any sunshine or rainbows.
On the 10th, John McIntyre, a convict who was employed by the governor to shoot for him, was dangerously wounded by a native named Pemulwuy while in quest of game in the woods at some considerable distance from the settlement. When brought in, he declared, and at a time that he had been quitted his arms, to induce him to look upon him as a friend, when the savage threw his spear at the distance of 10 yards with a skill that was fatally...
Unerring.
Unerring.
Yeah.
That's a new one.
It's different form of error.
Ah. When the spear was extracted, which was not until suppuration took place, it was found to have entered his body under the left arm to the depth of 7.5 inches. It was armed for 5 or 6 inches from the point with ragged pieces of shells fastened in gum. His recovery was immediately pronounced by Mr. White to be very doubtful.
Now, if you ever hear that voice, it's from David Collins, so I won't have to introduce any more quotes. While it was possible that the incident specifically was unprovoked, the circumstances in the greater region indicate that there was provocation galore.
Well, no doubt they gave a... Well, I mean, we know how this all turned out. What would happen is they would rock up with a bunch of convicts. The British aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I was choking on that so badly.
Because you hate them so much, you just couldn't spit it out.
Just the anger. they didn't know how to manage without thugs. They needed thugs. So what did they do? They turned to the worst of the worst convicts that were there.
The ones who volunteered.
And they gave them authority and weapons and a baton. And they sent them out there into the bush.
In the greater regions of Sydney, the settlers were destroying sacred sites, see Cockatoo Island a couple of episodes ago, clearing forests, cutting off access to ancient food sources such as fishing in Port Jackson, and killing Aboriginal people who came too close to their livestock. The spear's lining, that of redstone chips and shell shards, not only made it a deadly weapon, infection was just one issue that could arise if it cut you. It also helped the Europeans identify the tribe which the spearman was from. Such weaponry was used by the River Flat clan, which the Europeans called the Woodsman's Tribe. It wasn't the first time the woodsman came up against this particular European man on his hunts.
This man has been suspected of having wantonly killed or wounded several of the natives in the course of his excursions after game, but he steadily denied. From the time he was brought into his last moments of life, having ever fired at them but once, and then only in defense of his own life, which he thought in danger.
Knowing European people the way I do and knowing people who like guns the way I do, no doubt he was trying to shoot cans off a fence and accidentally shot at Aboriginal people.
I'd say what would happen is by this time, the Aboriginal people are going to be pretty apprehensive and scared of anyone rocking up with a gun. And so what they're going to do is they're going to try and scare them off. They're going to throw spears at them. They're going to do everything they can to get rid of them. And, you know, you can understand why.
Mm-hmm. Now, that quote above was specifically speaking of McIntyre, but he's not the only man who could fit into that description. It even fits the description of the Europeans as a whole. The spear in McIntyre resulted in a considerable amount of damage, reportedly penetrating far deep. Let me start that again because I've already said this one. I'm just going to skip this paragraph because it's actually part of that quote. And we have another quote here from Collins.
The governor determined to punish the offender, who, it was understood, restored with his tribe above the head of Botany Bay. He therefore directed that an armed party from the garrison should march thither and either destroy or make prisoners of 6 persons, if practical, of that tribe to which the aggressor belonged, carefully avoiding to offer any injury to either women or the children.
So considerate. You can shoot all the men as much as you want, just don't hit the women and the kids.
Yeah, go and round up 6 men that look like what he kind of described, and then we're going to lock them up. But don't kill the women and the children who you're about to leave without
their hunters.
Providers. They're hunters, yeah.
Protectors from other clans.
Yeah.
Governor Phillip was reportedly very reluctant to take this action, as he based his governorship on an idea of harmony with the native tribes, clearly something that happened a lot. Phillip himself had been wounded by a local called Willie Meering. I knew you were going to giggle at that.
I saw
your shoulders shake.
I did not.
Unable to
punish. I did not do it. I did not.
Oh, hi, Mark. Phillip himself had been wounded and unable to punish the man on the spot, he decided that he was just going to let him go. Now, Phillip's worry was that the local people were starting to take advantage of his men's unarmed status in order to attack without repercussion, and he thought there should therefore be something done to correct the issue. A party consisting of 2 captains, Tench of the Marines, and Hill of the New South Wales Corps, with 2 subalterns. I had to actually look that up because I had never heard that word before. A subaltern is a native man or woman without human agency. Does that sound like a slave to you?
Yes, I would say that is probably the definition of what a slave was. Yeah, 100%.
They also went out with 3 sergeants, 2 corporals, 1 drummer, because you've got to keep everyone marching in time, and 40 privates.
The assholes go marching one by one. Hurrah, hurrah.
We're shoot the natives just for fun.
Monty Python, right?
No.
Or was that just off the top
of
your head?
That was off the top of my head. It fit the beat.
It's because I know I married a racist. She can just come up with those so quickly.
Well, you said they were assholes. I was only getting in character.
It's true. Historically accurate. Historically accurate.
Two surgeons went with them.
I'm just taking the piss. She's the furthest racist you'll ever meet.
I hate everyone equally. 2 surgeons also set off with them. Now, they left with 3 days of provisions. Phillip figured they wouldn't find the actual woodsman, but they would put on enough of a show to make the locals think twice against acting out any more retribution. The idea was that the party would march around Parramatta, down to Botany Bay and back, making a show of hunting for the native who stabbed McIntyre. Only a few local people were actually spotted in the bush, and they quickly bailed when they saw the armed party heading for them. There was no sign of Pemulwuy, however, and the party returned to Government House on the 3rd day empty-handed. A second party was sent out but had the same luck, and with that, Phillip just fucking gave up.
I mean, he had better shit to worry about.
Yeah, he was trying to feed everyone.
Yeah, he was trying to keep he didn't want that job.
He has to try and settle these convict assholes that he fucking hates.
The convicts were fighting him. The Aboriginals were fighting him. The freemen, they got there, were fighting him.
He's like, fuck it. Like, we need you to keep going out and hunting food. We don't need you doing this.
John McIntyre ended up dying on January 22nd, 1791. So he held out for a month and 12 days with a 7.5-inch hole in his side that pierced a lung and basically collapsed his heart.
Yeah, he did pretty well.
He held on for an era without penicillin or any kind of antibacterial. He did fucking well.
Probably would have been best if he actually died of his wounds quicker.
Yeah, we have another quote here.
He had appeared to be recovering, but in the afternoon of that day died somewhat suddenly. On opening the body, the spear appeared to have wounded the left lobe of the lungs, which was found adhering to the side. In the cavity were discovered some of the pieces of stone and shells with which the weapon had been armed.
So no doubt there was an infection in there, and that's also what helped to destroy his collapsed lung.
Yeah, well, I mean, you put sea matter and you
stone
and together with a wound. But it's also quite interesting, like, if you look at their weaponry, for example. So, you know, they've absolutely littered the thing with sharp points. So it's got a penetrative point. And then all along the side, you got all these broken shells and pieces of stone.
Well, it reminds me of a coloured version of the Aztec axes with the obsidian chips down the side.
And the idea of it is, in those grooves, it's going to work very similar to a cat's claw. Cat's claws have all these little grooves.
Serrations.
The reason they have these beautiful little grooves, these little serrations, is so that they can trap bacteria inside. So even if their prey escapes them, there's a good chance that they may actually be able to track it a little bit further when the animal starts getting infected and getting sick.
The same theory is also in Komodo dragons and shark teeth.
Yeah, like, you get bitten by a Komodo dragon, you're probably going to die.
It's a bacterial infection, you are dead.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's quite ingenious. Like, a bit of rock, a few shells, bit of bacteria, got yourself a really good weapon there.
No sign was seen of the River Flat tribesmen, and the colony moved on without trying to feed themselves. The Third Fleet would not arrive until July, helping the settlers outnumber, not just outweapon, the local peoples of the area. Raids were undertaken by Pemulwuy and his group along the Hawkesbury River, at Brixfield's Hill, George's River, Hawkesbury River, the Parramatta, Prospect, and Toongabie from 1792.
And they were basically going out into the bush. They were hiding and they were attacking, taking what they needed and then disappearing back into the bush. Very similar to another folk hero that we all know and love, Robin Hood.
Yes. Because
it's kind of a similar, like,
If you want to call the Aboriginal people the poor and the white guys the rich, then yes, it works.
Well, I mean, you know, if they've got all the food and they've got all the supplies, then
they are the rich.
They're the rich, yeah. So, you know, and I mean, this is a proven tactic. Like, you see this happen again and again and again and again. All throughout history, every single conflict, your native population always knows how to use the environment against their attackers and their adversaries. And generally, it's, you know, if you're going to win in that sort of conflict, it's just because you absolutely pile on the bodies. You know, you pile in the people.
Or you do what America did in Vietnam and just burn the whole fucking thing to the ground.
Yeah. Well, and even then they still didn't win. So, you know, like, the Viet Cong is a very good example when we talk about guerrilla warfare. And if you've never heard,
what's the most famous example?
It is, absolutely. If you've never heard the term guerrilla warfare, it means using your locality to your advantage. So when American GIs would walk into and Australian, there was Australian people there too, UK, bunch of different well, it was a bad war and no one should have been there in the first place. But when they would walk into a village, they had no fucking clue who was actually Viet Cong and who was a normal everyday villager. Then the tactics started getting, like you said, Holly, they just burnt everything to the ground. A lot of people have even said that, you know, guerrilla tactics are always going to win out in major conflicts. And historically, yeah. A lot of the time it does. I mean, like, even when the Germany attempted to take down Russia, the German troops were not designed, like, you know, they weren't conditioned to be able to survive in the extremes of what, you know.
They went in on a summer campaign and ran out on a winter because they'd stayed too long.
Yeah. And the Russians were like, well, we know how to deal with this.
We're just going to sit here and drink and watch you die. Yeah,
this is nothing to us.
Yeah. It's always like you can always turn, even if you're going to lose in the end, I think you'll be able to hold out for quite some time using your local knowledge to your advantage.
Guerrilla warfare is generally used as a stalling technique because you can't find someone who buries tunnels and hides in the trees because you're generally walking around in a really bright uniform and you're easy to hit with a stone.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter what the settlers did, they could not catch the River Flat clan. Pemulwuy was injured a few times in his raids, but the fact that the European weapons barely slowed him down, let alone never came close to killing him, had both him and his tribesmen reportedly believing that he was immune to the weapons. As a result, Pemulwuy led every hunt himself and took great fun in taunting the Europeans they were raiding.
Now, do you think he actually believed he was bulletproof, aka Superman bulletproof?
It would not surprise me. He didn't believe he was bulletproof, he believed that they couldn't kill him. There's a difference.
Oh, okay.
He was still wounded, but he never died.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's
and this is the era of lead pellets, by the way.
Yeah, and man, I mean, that sort of confidence, that's going to lead you to be able to lead people quite comfortably.
It's the Tom Cruise method.
It absolutely is the Tom Cruise method. Tom Cruise believes that his thetan has been activated and gives him superpowers.
Which means that he can never be hurt, and therefore he does stupid stunts. So he should, by rights, be hurt, but he never gets hurt.
Also a terrible human being, but that's
not what we're talking about here.
You think he was like, you know, the power of my ancestors are protecting me. Like they're,
I
they're
don't
want to
try and comment
or,
on spirituality, but he definitely went, well they can't kill me.
Yeah, but it would have to have been linked to either that or, you know, to the other realm or...
That's his spirituality. I can't comment on it. I just don't know enough.
Yeah, but it is interesting. Like he probably thought he did have spiritual protections.
Quite possibly. Yeah. These raids weren't just for fun, however. The Europeans were pushing the Eora out of the area and slaughtering or clearing their food supplies. Neighbouring nations, some of whom were against the Flat River Clan tribe for various reasons, didn't help Pemulwuy or his family, leaving them to take on the Europeans if they were to survive. Survival, however, meant more than just food. In a foreshadow of what would happen to the local peoples within the next 100 years, settlers began kidnapping the local tribe's kids for ransom, as servants or as toys. Much like any civilization that came up against this, the First Nations did not take these kidnappings lightly. Raids were conducted on their holding cells, as settlers neither wounded or killed for the slight.
Isn't it funny when you put kids in cages, people start getting really shitty at you for doing it?
Yeah, they tend to get you to stop. Aside from the odd raid, Pemulwuy disappears from the history books for a few years. Now, he ended up reappearing again as part of a coming-of-age ceremony attended by David Collins.
Between the ages of 8 and 16, the males and females undergo the operation which they term gunong, that of having the septum nasi bored, to receive a bone or reed, which among them is deemed a great ornament. Though I have seen many whose articulation was thereby rendered very imperfect, between the same years also the males receive the qualifications which are given to them by losing one of their front teeth. On the 25th of January 1795, we found that the natives were assembling in numbers for the purpose of performing this ceremony. Several youths, well known among us, never having submitted to the operation, were now to be made men. Pemulwuy, a wood native, and many strangers came in. But the principals in the operation, not only being arrived from Kemmery, the intermediate knights were to be passed in dancing.
Two things. The septum nasi is the bit between your nostrils, so they were giving them a bull's ring, basically, with a reed or a stick or a bone. And the other thing was losing a front tooth was apparently a mark of being an adult, which I guess is just pointing out that it won't grow back.
Ironically, it's exactly what animators use with kids in cartoons to-
The kids don't have the hole?
To show that they're little, you know, because they're missing a tooth.
Yeah.
It's interesting how symbology changes and how context is so important to it.
Well, just different cultures have different meanings behind different things.
And this is how we all grow. The more you know, do do do.
It's also worth noting that the Europeans didn't actually go in and raid this ceremony. They let them do it. And from memory, it was a 7 or 10 day wait for the primary people to show up. So they had 10 days to go in there, bust it up. They didn't. They let them do whatever ceremonies they needed to and let them disperse again. They didn't even go in after Pemulwuy.
There were general anthropologists. Like, yeah. there were scientists out there. Like, it's not as if there weren't people
they were
interested in what was happening.
Naturalists. They yeah. weren't anthropologists. Then it was naturalists.
Naturalism, you know. Like, this is the same, you know, it's around the same time Darwin is.
Yeah. No, Darwin was 18, I think. I'll yeah. look it up. You keep talking.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's not like there aren't scientists who are actually generally curious about what's going on. I mean, Collins felt the urge to document all of this. Like, without Collins, we don't know any of this.
Yeah, Charles Darwin was around in 1809 to 1882. This is literally predating him by like 10 years.
Well, there you go. So there were scientists out there.
Yeah. In 1794, 1795, a drought fell upon the land, and with it came hard times for the settlers and the locals alike. The settlers, with a greater stretch to their reach, ordered more provisions sent from India. Although issues around the world at the time meant they were wary of the provisions arriving before the next transport.
So I assume if it's coming from India, that's coming from the India Trading Company.
Not necessarily. The British had settlements in India, so they could just literally put them on the cargo ships and send them over. They didn't have to deal with the British Trading Company.
But that, well, I thought the Trading Company was like the corporation of Britain.
Yes and no. You had the British East India Trading Company, the British East India Company, but you also had just regular merchants who were transporting spices and stuff on their own.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So you could go either way depending on who was going to get there first.
True, true.
At the time, I actually went through and looked it up because I'm like, what the fuck is happening around the time that this shit's going on? The Haitian Revolution is decimating the Haitian population. The French Revolutionary Wars are taking place in Europe. The first Carib War, which is in the Caribbean, was going on, and there was a whole host of other small conflicts. And that's just the shit Britain was in.
Yeah, it's because Britain was becoming the biggest kingdom that the world had ever seen. And at this point in time, you could nearly say that the British kingdom will probably be the largest kingdom that, you know, the largest collective of nations that we'll ever see.
The sun never sets on the British Empire.
And it was true. It was absolutely true. But with that come, with, you know, a reach like that, and they wanted the world,
mm-hmm.
You're going to come into conflict, aren't you?
Well, they didn't specifically just want the world. They didn't want the French to have the world, and they yep. didn't want the Spanish or the German or the Russian to have the world. Yep. They wanted the world.
And one of the most common things that would actually occur when they did enter into conflicts like this is that they would start like bribing locals that they liked, mm-hmm. and then they would, you know, they would set them up against, you know, their brothers and sisters. Like, it was horrific, absolutely horrific.
The British East India Company was also involved in a few wars at the time, which is one of the reasons why they couldn't fully supply all the ships. And I find it funny that a fucking trading company is in the middle of wars.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
not just supplying the wars, they were actually in there fighting in the wars.
But everything changed, Holly, and corporations never got involved in war ever again.
And they definitely didn't ship armaments around the world.
We're hippies, fuck off.
We want to live in that reality.
We want to live in peace, man.
Rations for the settlers were cut as a result of the ruling class hoping to save enough food to get them to their next supplies. As usual, when something changed in their living conditions, the settlers rebelled, pushing logs into rivers to stop boats so they could commandeer their loads, attacking carts and robbing their fellows for grain. Basically, the entire settlement turned into a bush-ranging orgy.
Nice. Bit hard, though, with all those helmets.
Well, not all of them wore helmets, Matthew.
Should always wear a helmet to an orgy, Holly.
That's unfortunate. How are you doing, Dong? Oh, whoops, sorry, got too close.
It was a condom joke, but either way, you can take that literally, it's fine.
At the same time,
children listen to the show, don't they?
Yeah, my nieces and nephews.
But she checks, right? She listens to the episode.
She tells
first.
Me she does, but I'm not sure.
Mm.
However, at the same time, the local peoples also got in on the act as well.
The natives appeared in large bodies, men, women, children, provided with blankets and nets to carry off the corn, of which they appeared as fond as the natives who lived among us, and seemed determined to take it whenever and wherever they could meet with opportunities. In their attacks, they conducted themselves with much art, But where that failed, they had recourse to force, and on the least appearance of resistance, made use of their spears and clubs.
Basically, I'm taking the corn. If you don't give it to me, I'm just going to beat you over the head until I take it anyway.
This is my corn now. Just give me that corn. So was this like the very first example of trick-or-treating? If they didn't hand over the corn, they would then end up with a trick.
Trick, bag, treat,
I'm going to club you. Yeah.
That's not that far removed, is it? Like our American listeners, let us know on the Facebook page.
America's like, well, burn down the house, give me candy. Which one are we going?
Are children that dangerous now in America? Do they just come packing when they knock on the door? You know, pull out a pistol, or make with the candy pops.
And that's like a 5-year-old. Captain William Patterson set a party of the New South Wales Corps to destroy as many of the Flat River clan as they could find and hang their bodies from trees as a warning, because of course they couldn't read declarations, so they had to do a physical example.
Same thing they did to pirates, wasn't it?
Hang them at the edge of the cove. The River Flat clan were killed, but the bodies vanished before they could be hung, so there was no actual kill count available for the campaign.
Was that the rest of the tribe securing the bodies for burial?
I was like, fuck you, I'm taking them.
Well, there are rites and practices that need to happen during burial.
Just like everyone. More parties were sent out to the point where this became one of their regular duties, and thus the wonderful Border Force was born. Matthew read ahead by like three words, I think.
Oh, dear. Dear, I like it.
I know you haven't read this far in the script, because you get to the jokes and you're like, hey, that's funny.
This is social commentary.
The settlers track... Oh, this is for Matthew to read, sorry.
This actually comes from Peter Taylor from Australia, the first 12 years. The settlers tracked them as far as the outskirts of Parramatta, but lost them there. About an hour later, a large band of natives came into the settlement, headed by Pemaway. Now screaming his defiance, Pemaway threatened to spear the first man who tried to take him, and actually did throw his spear at a soldier who moved towards him. It was the start of a furious fight, and by the time it was over, 5 Aborigines had been killed by musket fire, and Pemaway himself had been severely wounded.
7 pieces of buckshot were lodged in his head and body, again, not killing him, and he was taken to a hospital, clapped in irons. However, he managed to escape, irons and all, once he'd recovered sufficiently. A month later, he saw the governor's party while on a tour and asked one of the help if the governor was still angry at him.
So, now, you know, me and your governor have had a bit of a frosty relationship. I keep knocking on his door, demanding all of his corn because we really enjoy it and we don't want to club you and you give us the corn. So, and I didn't mean to throw the spear. Hey, look, are we all good? We all good? You got any issues with me in particular here? Like, just feeling it out. Just feeling it out. Can we text again?
Pemaway.
Text being, of course, they'd load up smoke a pigeon signals. Or, you know.
Pemaway was assured the man was not angry with him, and he was reportedly very happy to hear about this twist of fate.
So, because they wanted to arrest him, right? Yeah, so,
They were going to hunt him.
He wants you to do you like corn? Do you like scones? It's the only other thing that us white people will bring here.
Scotch and smallpox. Those are your choices. Which one do you want?
Ooh.
It's true.
It is true, yes.
Later that year, Pemaway and his group attacked a bunch of settlers, amongst whom was Black Caesar. The settlers managed to beat back the Eora, with Black Caesar taking his own place in history by being one of the few people who managed to hurt Pemaway. He hit him in the head so hard that he actually managed to crack the native man's skull.
Wow. And we talked about that as well when we did the episode about Black Caesar, episode 20?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In March 1797, Pemaway led a raid on the government buildings of Toongabi. Incensed at his boldness, as this was not some farm on the outskirts of town, this was a seat of power, the settlers banded together to catch him. Once again, Pemaway escaped and vanished. I think I feel like there's a high failure rate for the Europeans at this point.
Do you see why I call him Australia's John Wick?
Yeah.
Like, He becomes the Baba Yaga. Like, he just goes in, kills everyone,
smacks them and piss off.
Yeah. He's probably loving it. He's probably loving every second of it.
Yeah, he's probably going back on. Yeah, I got more four more Europeans. And you see the where scar the now? Yeah, scar.
Where the fuck is this movie? I want to see this movie.
Well, we need to talk to the lady who did Nightingale and Babadook. Babadook.
Yeah, that seems like
we'll get that organized.
Up our alley, yeah.
On May 1, 1801, the new governor, Governor Philip Gidley King, ordered any Aboriginal seen near Parramatta, the Georges River, or Prospect to be shot on sight, and all the others to be driven back as far from the settlements as possible. This, of course, led to a resurgence and direct confrontations between the locals and the settlers, because that's what happens when you kick them out of their place.
I think Governor Philip, the previous governor, Gidley King. Governor Philip, I think he understood that in order for his colony to survive, it needed to have as less conflict as possible. Mm-hmm. He definitely wasn't above having innocent people killed. He absolutely would order that. But you can tell that he understood that, you know, for them to all exist, there had to be some semblance of peace sometimes, whereas King didn't give a fuck.
No, he's like, kill them all. Get them the fuck out of my space.
And all that did was just ramp up the violence. It just meant more people would die. And they never succeeded in that full eradication.
No. Aboriginal people and settlers alike were killed in the fighting, some just trying to protect their families and their homes. Pemulwuy stepped up to guide and lead, refusing to take this new decree laying down. By November 1801, Pemulwuy was made an official outlaw with a reward on his head, dead or alive.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
I knew you were going to do that.
Yeah, you did.
In spite of this, it took 7 months for the reward to be claimed, which is actually pretty short considering how long they'd been after him. On June 2nd, 1802, news reached Governor King that Pemulwuy was dead, shot by Henry Hacking.
Henry's my name.
Like a lot of native peoples at the time, Pemulwuy's head was removed from his body, pickled, and sent to England under the guise of a study, but more likely as a trophy. It was shipped to Sir Joseph Banks in London, who was actually a naturalist, so he wasn't a headhunter. He was there to study it. I'm doing air quotes around that just so that everyone knows. And it was possibly sent on to the Royal College of Surgeons afterwards. In 1948, the skull may have been taken to the Natural History Museum in London when they took 3,000 skulls that were part of the college's collection. However, it's possible that the skull was actually destroyed in the Blitz.
The Royal College of Surgeons was extensively bombed in 1941, and over half the specimens in their collection were destroyed. Historians welcomed news of the renewed effort to return the head, but they said the trail had run cold many times before.
And that was from Off With His Head from the Sydney Morning Herald in 2010. It was an title. It was an article about Prince Harry and Prince William. That's why they used that.
Oh, okay.
The location of Pemulwuy's head has since been lost to time, as is the way of skulls taken by trophy hunters.
Now, interesting little coincidence, our other roguish figure of Australian history, of course, shares this similar fate. Both Ned Kelly's skull is gone, disappeared to time, as is Pemulwuy. So it's interesting that you sort of have these two, because some people will argue that Ned Kelly was somewhat of a freedom fighter. Some will argue he was a domestic terrorist. Some would argue that he was an absolute extreme lover. And some will argue that he was an Irish piece of shit.
Mostly other Irish people.
Yeah. It's just, but, you know, if you want to say, like, okay, Australia's first freedom fighters, isn't it both interesting that for both of them, they ended up their head moving around and being lost to history. I just find that synchronicity very, very bizarre.
For all we know, in spite of being beheaded 76 years apart, they could be on the same shelf in a collector's house at the moment, unlabeled and unknown.
It fucking could be, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Some asshole could be dusting. Yeah, some asshole could be dusting the skull of Ned Kelly right next to the skull of Pemulwuy, and they'd never know.
Yeah.
Whew.
In 2010, when visiting Australia, Prince William promised elders whom he met on tour that he would make it his mission to find and repatriate the skull. The efforts have so far borne no fruit, but there are occasional updates to, all right, we've searched here and we still can't find the records. We searched here, we can't find them. So he is still trying. He's just not very good at it.
There have been a lot of movements toward repatriating It is a slow and drawn out process that doesn't need to be as slow and drawn out as it is.
Well,
but it
not
does
only
happen.
Do you have to find things, you have to authenticate that that's the thing you found, which can be problematic when you don't have its provenance.
DNA testing is helping a lot.
If you don't have descendants, you've got nothing to DNA test against.
True, but it's like, I mean, you know, there are certain genetic markers. But like I said, I'm shitting on it, but at the same time, I'm saying that, yes, there are moves being made to try and repatriate things. I mean, you know, we talked about that when we discussed the man.
Mungo Man?
Mungo Man. That, you know, that was a repatriation story.
Mungo Woman as well. You
know, they brought them back to where they were meant to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
It is happening. It's just slow.
Yeah. We have a quote here from the Sydney Morning Herald with King's opinion of Pemulwuy.
A terrible pest to the colony. He was brave and an independent character. And that's how Governor King referred to him, who ordered his death.
He was a pain in the ass, but he was an all right kind of guy. If he wasn't such a pain in the ass, he would have been an all right kind of guy.
Well, the shit stirring aspect of like talking to the governor's party to be like, hey, is he still pissed at me or what? Like that, it's interesting. Like, it's not unknown to have adversaries that also respect each other.
Yeah.
You know, just because you hate someone's guts doesn't mean you can't respect when they pull off a good move.
Well, isn't that the high point of British sophistication, is that you can go smack each other around and sit down and have dinner?
I have no fucking clue. I have no, like, I'm a rebellious Australian.
You're more of an Irish than you are an English.
Absolutely.
Pemulwuy wasn't the last of his tribe to stand up against the British. His son, Tedbury, was a friend of John MacArthur's and was present at the Rum Rebellion. When he found out Bligh was in custody, he actually approached his friend John and offered to spear Bligh for him. However, Tedbury is actually someone we're going to talk about another day because he has his own stories to tell.
Yes, yes. But yeah, there you go. Another Australian freedom finder. It's very interesting stuff. Now, if you would like to get in contact with us here at Weird Crap in Australia, you can do so in a couple of ways. Social media, type in Weird Crap in Australia into that Facebook search engine. Same for Instagram and on Twitter. Our handle is at Weird Crap in Oz, AUS. You can also get yourself a t-shirt. Would you like a t-shirt, Holly?
Yes,
actually, you have several of our
t-shirts.
I have,
yes.
You actually wear several of our t-shirts.
I think I've got three designs. I've got the cover, I've got the logo, and I've got the UFO.
Yeah, I think I've got like six maybe. I really like them. I like them so much because they're designed by Weird Crap in Australia artist Ignacio Di Meli Meglio. Yes. Pretty sure it's Meglio. He always gives me shit about that. of course, like Ignacio is the guy behind our upcoming comic book, Killaroo Semper Fi. Amazing artist. And you want to support Weird Crap in Australia. You want to look cool while you're doing it. Head to our Redbubble store, weirdcrapinoz.redbubble.com. Oz spelled A-U-S. You'll be able to pick up one of those very cool designs. My personal favorite is the Australian Legends t-shirt, it's probably about time we did a sequel to that too and included Ignacio's interpretation of someone like Pemulwuy.
We'll see.
He could definitely make one of the four because we've definitely got some more weird fucking monsters to add to that shit. But yeah, we haven't done a t-shirt design in a little while, but we've got like 10?
I think there's six.
Is there?
Well, there's three on the wall.
There's three on the wall.
There's at least another two that are in our closets. Yep. So there's at least six.
Yeah, but what's cool about Redbubble is they do it all. So they do posters, they do coasters. You select one of Ignacio's designs, pick the product you want, and you can actually customize it. And then you get a collectible or a piece of merchandise that you want made for you, you know, for your bar, for wearing on your chest.
Slapping on everything because they do stickers as well.
They do towels. Do everything. It's fucking wonderful. Weird Crap in Oz, aus.redbubble.com. Go check that out. And also subscribe to their email because they often do site-wide discounts.
And they don't tell anyone.
And they always leave it to the last minute. And we'd love to get that info out to you so you get a shirt for a lot cheaper. Sign up to their newsletter. Follow us as a creator. And as soon as things get cheap, what they'll do is they'll shoot you through an email with a code. Then you'll be able to get one of our shirts for even less.
Yep.
So if you've been hanging out for one but you don't have the coin, that's how I do it.
That's a loose solution.
Absolutely.
You can also find us on Patreon, like a lot of other podcasts. Patreon is, for anyone not accustomed to it, it's basically a subscription service for extra content. So each week we record what we call a mini-sode. That's about, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. And we talk about some of the more interesting weird stories that are happening in our country presently. And we also upload things like interviews that we do. Just recently, actually, a friend of ours who did some work on a film, the producers of that film want to talk to us, you know. So those sort of, we never tell anyone not to contact us because we love talking to people. We put those on the Patreon only side of things. And you're probably being like, oh my God, Matt, you know, I don't. Paid content, man. Like, gee, I get this for free. Why would I pay for more? Well, not only does your Patreon fee help keep this going, so you still get more of the stuff you love, but for only $5 a month, you also get 4 bonus podcasts as well as interviews and any other little bits and pieces that we can put up on that Patreon site. So if you love the show, you want more of it, head to Patreon. Oh, another sexy bonus for only $5 a month. You will actually get our mainline episodes completely ad-free because people have complained when they get stuck with an ad. And we also try and release it earlier as well.
I'm averaging about 12 hours early release.
Yeah, we're trying to get it up to a couple of days. But yeah, if you want all that content ad-free, you want it early, Patreon, Weird Crap in Australia, only cost you $5 a month.
Yep.
Pretty cheap.
Yep.
Pretty cheap. We've also got a book, Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 1. You can get yourself a paperback copy from lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, and you can grab it from Amazon or Kindle. And Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 2 is coming out 1st of September this year. Do yourself a favor, grab 5 copies, send them off to your mates, and then me and Holly will be able to retire. Otherwise, that's it for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast for another week. As is customary, we hand the last few words off to Holly Soul.
I like history. That's all I'm really going to add to this.
They are her favorite episodes. We know that for sure. Otherwise, folks, have a great day, and we will catch you very soon for more Weird Crap in Australia. Bye for now.
See yous.
This has been a production of The Modern Meltdown. For more podcasts just like it, head to themodernmeltdown.net.